Okay, well, thank you first to the organizers of this seminar for inviting me to give a talk. I will be talking on unipotent flows on the moduli space of abelian differentials in genus 2. That is, certain submanifolds in genus 2 of the space of translation surfaces. So thank you in particular to Anton Zorich. I don't know if he's sitting here somewhere, but he set things up very nicely in his wonderful lecture in three parts. Okay, so the, I guess, buzzword that's going to be floating in and out of the talk is Ratner. So what I've actually done along with Kevin Wortman at Yale University is to prove a type of Ratner theorem for translation surfaces specific types in genus 2. So I'm actually going to kill the suspense of the talk and tell you what the theorem is before we can really make sense of every term in the theorem. But this will give you something to think about throughout the talk. So the theorem is a measure classification, and it says that let's suppose mu is an ergodic UT invariant probability measure on a certain type of submanifold in the stratum of abelian differentials H11. So let me fill in some details. First, let me say that UT is the group of unipotent upper triangular matrices in SL2R. And H11, I believe Anton has used this notation before, but this is the stratum of genus 2 translation surfaces with two conical singularities. Okay, so we will be looking at U invariant ergodic probability measures on certain submanifolds, closed submanifolds, in the stratum H11, and we have a classification theorem for precisely those types of measures. They can be either one of two types. The first type is that there is a surface in the closed submanifold, dm, so that the U orbit of m is closed or periodic. It is homeomorphic to S1. And then mu is the arc length measure supported on that periodic orbit. The next piece of the classification states that if mu is not the first type of measure, then mu is, in fact, SL2R invariant. And in the case when mu is an SL2R invariant measure on the submanifold of the type dm, then it's work of Curtis McMullen, who has classified the SL2R invariant measures on the submanifold dm. And later on in the talk, we will discuss the measure classification of McMullen. Okay, the reference for, by the way, McMullen's measure classification, he has just a series of astonishing papers. The SL2R measure classification is in his paper, Dynamics of SL2R, and it goes on, it actually goes on to say, I think, on the moduli space of abelian differentials in genus 2. But if you wanted to look up which paper this is in Kurt's paper on the dynamics of SL2R. Okay, so we will be, of course, revisiting this theorem later in the talk. What? We will say what the submanifolds DM are. We will describe them in detail. Let's see. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is to take a step back into the world of homogeneous spaces. And just to review what one of Marina Ratner's theorems, one of the theorems that people mean when they say a Ratner theorem. She really has, I suppose, three theorems, three major theorems. One of them, I think, is usually referred to as her theorem on orbit closures. So, Ratner's theorem on orbit closures allows for the following data. You take G, which is a Lie group. You let gamma be a lattice in G, that is, the discrete finite volume subgroup in G. And you let UT be a unipotent subgroup of G. Now, Ratner's theorem is powerful in the sense that it says any the orbit under the unipotent group of any point is a nice submanifold of the homogeneous space G mod gamma. But she's more specific than that. She says that, in particular, the closure of the U orbit of any class X in the homogeneous space G mod gamma is what's known as homogeneous. Sometimes I've also heard the word algebraic used. So I'm not sure which is more standard, but sometimes I think Ratner herself may have used the term algebraic instead of homogeneous. Well, what does that mean? It means that for each X in G, there is a close connected subgroup S of G, so that the unipotent elements UT are contained in S. Furthermore, the class XS is closed in the homogeneous space G mod gamma and has finite S invariant volume. And lastly, that the UT orbit of X is dense in excess. Let me make one comment. Where is this word homogeneous coming from? In other words, you can state two by saying that, if I get this right, X inverse gamma X intersect S is a lattice. That's an exercise. You can show that's the same. So this is Ratner's theorem on orbit closures for homogeneous spaces. And for the rest of the talk, I'd like to compare and contrast the theorem for homogeneous spaces with the theorem with Wortmann that I mentioned earlier. There are some similarities, and yet there are some significant differences. So the proof in the case for Ratner's theorem in homogeneous spaces is not quite the same as in our situation, although there are certainly similarities. Okay, so furthermore, Ratner has a measure classification theorem. I'd say this is maybe the classification theorem that is more relevant for this talk. And again, the input data is that G is a Lie group, gamma is a lattice in G, and UT is a unipotent flow on G mod gamma. Then her theorem says that every ergodic UT invariant probability measure mu on G mod gamma is supported on one of those nice submanifolds, the orbit closure, that we discussed in Ratner's orbit closure theorem. So again, here I've said mu is homogeneous, but again, the term algebraic has also been applied to describe these measures. Okay. So those are two of Ratner's theorems for homogeneous spaces. Next, I'd like to just talk about an example in the homogeneous space case before moving on to surfaces. Example, let's let G be equal to SL2R. I choose this example because SL2R will factor prominently for the rest of the talk. Let's let gamma be the lattice SL2Z in SL2R. And as before, let's let UT denote the unipotent upper triangular matrices in SL2R. Now, I should maybe have a line that comes right here on the slide. The fact is that the only closed, connected subgroups of G that contain those matrices UT are G itself, G being SL2R, the subgroup U, unipotent upper triangular matrices, and also of AU, which is the subgroup of upper triangular matrices. Okay, not necessarily unipotent. So A here, and for the rest of the talk, will be the standard diagonal matrices in SL2R. Okay, so the only close connected subgroups of G that contain UT are G, U itself, and the subgroup of upper triangular matrices. Ratner's orbit closure theorem says then that S, the only candidates for this closed connected subgroup S that's mentioned in the orbit closure theorem are G, U, and AU itself. Okay, now AU can be shown, it doesn't have a lattice, so really the only candidates for S are U and S equals G. So what this implies is that each UT orbit on the homogeneous space SL2R mod SL2Z is either closed or dense. Okay, so this is an example of Ratner's theorem for the homogeneous space SL2R mod SL2Z. Run out of space on the transparency. Let me make a few remarks. You're gonna have to tell me if you can. It's a little dark. Can that be seen or no? It's a shrug. Oh, by you. Okay. Well, good that it can be seen by you. Okay. Just some general remarks. Let's see. If instead we replace these matrices UT, don't write too low. Won't do that either. If we replace UT by AT, then you can apply Ratner's theorem. You can't apply Ratner's theorem. Okay, and that's because while UT is a unipotent flow AT, the geodesic flow is not. And in fact, under the geodesic flow, you can have orbit closures that are not particularly nice at all. Orbit closures can be fractal. However, let me know if I'm going too low. I can raise it. Okay. Oh, nobody laughs when I raise this because I think it's kind of heavy. All right. The board weighs probably as much as I do. So, right. Ratner's theorem does not apply for the geodesic flow. However, you can show that almost every UT and AT orbit is dense in the whole space G. Okay, so the set of points under the geodesic flow that have whose orbit is not a nice submanifold is actually quite small. Okay, Most of the time these orbits are dense, and so the orbit closures are the whole space. However, the upshot of Ratner's theorem is that you can take this almost every and replace it by every, okay, in the case when you have a unipotent flow. So Ratner allows one to replace almost every with every. Okay, and I think that's all I want to say about Ratner's theorem right now. Okay, so moving in to the world. Oh, this is so fancy. Move back. The lights go out. Let's move back toward the world of surfaces. Okay. Okay. So, as Anton has said before, and I mentioned earlier in the talk, H11 is the stratum of genus 2 translation surfaces with two conical singularities. One can show each of these singularities has total angle 4 pi. I see some smiles because the regular decagon, which has haunted me for years, is now back. And a new friend, the Z table. So let me attempt to draw the regular decagon and the Z table. These are great examples. I think I'll try to draw them on the board because I'd like to refer to them properly. You like me to draw on that side? Oh, the podium. Okay. Great. Oh, am I missing something? This is like when I teach calculus and the kids, they laugh. I turn around, they're like, ha, ha, laugh. Not that funny. All right. So let's try and approximate a picture of the regular decagon. Okay, so we can form a genus 2 translation surface in the stratum H11 by taking a regular decagon oriented in the plane and gluing opposite sides. Okay, let me not go through and make all of the identifications, but you just glue sides that are parallel, as you usually do with translation surfaces. If you do this, you will find that you actually have two equivalence classes of vertices under the identification. And these two equivalence classes represent the conical singularities, the two conical singularities on the decagon. So this is, in fact, in the stratum H11. Okay, so that's one surface, and we'll return to this surface for later examples. Another example is a Z table of a certain kind. In fact, I think I may have rotated the picture of a Z table. Okay. So it's not really a... It's a rotated Z table, I suppose. And what I mean here, although it doesn't look like it, is for this table to be built of squares. So there's a square on top here that has side length 1. The square in the middle has side length 1 plus A, and the lower square has side length A. And for certain reasons, I would like to choose A to be a positive rational, irrational number of the form B minus 1 plus square root of B squared minus B plus 1. I got that equation right. Okay, so what are we looking at in the Z table? Well, I'd like you to think of this surface as having a three horizontal cylinder decomposition. So the opposite horizontal sides are identified. Okay. We haven't used this term before. A cylinder decomposition of a surface is just a decomposition of the surface into unions of closed geodesics, closed trajectories, which are bounded by saddle connections. So I'm filling in the singularity data right here. These are my two equivalence classes of singularities. Okay, and identifications continue as follows: 4 and 4 and 5 and 5. Okay, so we will come back to this z-table, but it is, you can check via an Euler characteristic argument, this is in genus 2, and it does have two conical singularities. So this is in H1-1. Okay. Why A takes this form, I'll discuss in a while. Okay. See? Continuing with surfaces, it's a fact that's been discussed in this conference before that the group SL2R acts on each stratum in the moduli space of abelian differentials. Now let me give you a definition. I'm not sure if we've seen this definition in a series of talks before, but we say that a translation surface is a lattice surface if its stabilizer under this SL2R action is a lattice itself in the group SL2R. So, what are some examples of lattice surfaces? Well, in fact, the regular decagon with opposite sides identified is a lattice surface. Okay? So, this is a lattice surface. Okay? That was shown by Bill Veach. It's in the paper of Veach. And now the given z-table, meaning the z-table that I have drawn here, is actually not a lattice surface. But maybe I won't go into this definition right now. It's not necessary for this talk, but if you've heard this term before, I've chosen the number A so that the given z-table is completely periodic. Okay. One more thing to note that's interesting about this Z table is that the given table has an infinitely generated Veach group. By Veach group, I mean the SL2R stabilizer of the surface is infinitely generated. For a long time, it was not known whether there were examples of surfaces whose Veach groups were infinitely generated. This fact can be found in, again, a paper of McMullen. And this time, it's, I hope I get this right, tight cumulonimbus geodesics of infinite complexity. Yeah, it could be a rational number. I think, yeah. Thanks. Okay, so that's something interesting to note about the given Z table. Okay, the next thing I'd like to talk about are things that I call perturbations of surfaces in H1-1. Just to let you know what's coming up, just a 2-minute outline of the next 20 minutes of the talk, we're going to talk about two different ways of moving around inside the stratum H11. One way you already know, that's using the SL2R action. And the other way we're going to discuss of moving around inside the stratum is what I'll call perturbations. And this is particular to the stratum H11. So I've given a sort of a description in words. It's probably easier to see, and I'm going to go back to the decagon. But the idea is to take a surface, S, in the stratum H11, and a sufficiently small vector, V, in R2. I will explain what sufficiently small means. Doing this and taking these two pieces of data, we can actually form a new translation surface. I'll label that SV, which still lies in the stratum H11. And the way to do that geometrically is, let me get some colored chalk. Fix a singularity of S and take your vector V and add that vector V to, let's say, each vertex that appears in a polygonal representation of your translation surface. Okay, so let's fix the, let's say, X vertices and add this vector V to each and every one of them. Okay, we're going to get 5 new X vertices this way. Now, the idea is to hold fixed the dot vertices and then play connect the dots with the old dot vertices and the new X vertices. Let's see. Yeah, okay. So I won't draw the picture all the way around, but you do this all the way around. And again, what you do to form the surface SV is to glue opposite sides, okay? If this is a little difficult to see, it probably is in this picture. What we're actually doing is changing the relative homology of the surface. So we're changing those segments that connect to distinct singularities. What we are not doing is changing the loops or the absolute homology in the surface. Okay? Nevertheless, when we change the relative homology of the surface, we are getting a new translation surface, SV. Okay? It still has genus 2. It still has, and here's a caveat I need to issue. Typically, it will still have 2 conical singularities. So here's a caveat. When I said that the vector V had to be sufficiently small, I do not want to perturb by any vector V that will take one of my singularities into the other. So it's possible to move along a vector V and you run the X vertices into the dot vertices. That means that you're dropping a stratum. Okay, you'll have a genus 2 surface, but it will be in the stratum H of 2, which has just 1 conical singularity. Okay? So the caveat throughout this talk, we will not consider vectors V that drop the surface S to the lower stratum H of 2. Okay, we don't want to run those 2 singularities into each other. You can do a small V, a sufficiently small V. Yes. No. If V is sufficiently small, yes, you're safe. You keep a genus 2 surface, and it still has 2 conical singularities. Okay. So someone asked earlier, what are these submanifolds that you classified these unipotent U-invariant ergodic probability measures on? I called them DM before. Okay. We will use this idea of perturbations in H11 to describe these manifolds. Okay, so remember, the manifolds I am about to describe are these manifolds, which I called later DM. Okay, so let's start with the surface, M in H11. Surfaces in H11, for topological reasons, I guess. Surfaces in H11 can have cylinder decompositions where there are a different number of cylinders in the decompositions. I just want to look at cylinder decompositions where there are three cylinders in the decomposition. Okay, now I'm going to let Wi and Hi be the width and height parameters of these cylinders. So, there's always a finite, yes. That's constricted by the genus and the singularity data. Okay. Yes, for example, in H of 2, the maximum number of cylinders that you can have in a cylinder decomposition is 2 rather than 3. Okay? All right, I'm halfway there. I've already started to draw the Z table again. Might as well finish it. Okay, so remember the Z table we were considering had a horizontal cylinder decomposition. I will be or denote, I'm too low again. I'll raise this up in a minute. Wi will be the length of the closed trajectory, the closed core trajectory of the cylinder. And Hi, so here's, let's say, we label this cylinder 1. This length here is width 1. H1 will be measured in the orthogonal direction. H1 is the height of the cylinder. And now, because a cylinder decomposition, due to, I guess, topological considerations again, you can always number cylinders in a three-cylinder decomposition of a surface in H11 so that the width of this third cylinder here is the sum of the widths of the first two. Okay, so we're going to number cylinders so that the width of the third is equal to the width of the second cylinder plus the width of the first. Oh, man. Okay. Oh, that was great. Okay. Right here. Okay. So we can, this effect, always number cylinders in a three-cylinder decomposition in that way. Okay, there's the height. If you notice on the slide, I say, I don't want to consider the height parameters. I'm actually going to switch parameters. And that's what I will do. Instead of looking at the height, I'm going to look at parameters Si, which are equal to Hi plus H3. So, again, H3 is the height of that special cylinder 3. Okay? What you're really doing when you switch parameters is the following. If this saddle connection represents the height of the first cylinder, and I'm just copying the left-hand side of this picture right down here, we draw the other saddle connection, which represents the height of the third cylinder, then what S does is to represent, instead of relative classes of homology, it represents a loop or an absolute class of homology. So let me write that down. The Hi represent classes of the relative homology. Those are not closed loops, but the SI represent classes of the absolute homology. Okay, and that's the reason for the requirement equation. Okay, so here's a theorem which shows the existence of these certain submanifolds. First, let's take a number in a field of the form Q root D. You can pick D, any D that you want, as long as it's positive. And let's let Dn be the set of surfaces in H11 that have area M and which have a cylinder decomposition so that the width and parameters, I had written Hi here, but that now should say Si, are in Q root D. Okay? So you can choose the D, and we can find a submanifold of this type. Okay? So every surface in this submanifold has a cylinder decomposition so that if you calculate the width and the parameters S, they satisfy the equation that W1 S1 bar equals minus W2 S2 bar. Okay, now bar here denotes algebraic conjugation in the field Q root D. Okay, so that describes the collection of surfaces, but the theorem is that Dm, as described, is a closed SL2R invariant submanifold in H11. Okay, these are the submanifolds on which we will be considering measures, U invariant ergodic probability measures. Okay, so these are the submanifolds Dm described in the theorem. So if we think a little bit about what's in Dm, well, if a surface S is in one of these submanifolds Dm, then that implies that for sufficiently small perturbation, so that SV is defined, SV is also in Dm. Okay? The reason why is because the criterion for being in the submanifold involves parameters that describe the absolute homology of the surface. But what was changing when we applied this perturbation? It was the relative homology of the surface. Okay? So changing the relative homology of the surface will not change membership in the submanifold Dm. Okay? Now, I've also said Dm is SL2R invariant, so of course the SL2R orbit of any surface is going to be contained in Dm as well. It may be interesting to note, I won't write it, but any Veitch surface, has to be contained in, any lattice surface must be contained in such a submanifold. Okay? All right, so that's our description of the submanifolds in the theorem. Because the classification of U invariant ergodic probability measures involves really the classification of the SL2R invariant measures, I would just like to go through McMullen's classification. This again is from his paper, Dynamics of SL2R. And he says the following. Let mu be an ergodic, in this case, SL2R invariant probability measure on Dm. Okay? Then he says that mu can be either one of two things. Either mu is the Haar measure on the orbit of a lattice surface, okay, or mu is supported on the full space Dm. Okay? Now, it turns out there are not too many examples of type 1 in the stratum H11, because in a paper that came after his dynamics paper, I believe that's called the regular decagon and beyond, McMullen showed the extraordinary fact that really the only lattice surfaces in H 1-1 are those that are in the SL2R orbit of the decagon. So recall from before that we said the decagon was a lattice surface. Well, anything that's in its SL2R orbit is also a lattice surface. Okay? Yeah. No, I'm going to define DM so that actually it doesn't include the non-primitive ones. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that is McMullen's classification. And now, keeping McMullen's classification in mind, let's talk about the I don't know if they're obvious, but let's talk about some examples that we know of ergodic U-invariant probability measures on DM. Okay, so this slide describes one type of ergodic U-invariant probability measure that can arise. So let's suppose that we have a surface S that has a horizontal cylinder decomposition. Now, we've seen examples of this in the talk before. In particular, the given Z table and the decagon have horizontal cylinder decompositions. Okay? Now, let's suppose, in addition to the fact that there is a horizontal decomposition, that the moduli of the cylinders are rational multiples of each other. Okay? So the moduli of a cylinder I, so the modulus of a cylinder I, is, I might flip this, I think it's the width over the height. I may have flipped that. Okay. So let's observe in the case of the Z tables, okay, that each of the cylinders is a square. Okay, so the height and width are the same. So the moduli of each of those cylinders is just one, okay, because the height and width are the same. So now, if you have a cylinder decomposition where the moduli are rational multiples of each other, then the U orbit of S is homeomorphic to F1. It closes up. Okay, in fact, yeah, I might get this wrong, but I need help with this. The matrix 1L01, where L is, I'm trying to say the some sense the least common multiple of the numbers WI over HI. I think if the WI over HI are rational multiples of each other, then that matrix, which is in U, this is in the Veitch group of the surface. Okay, it's affecting a Dane twist. So one type of U-invariant ergodic probability measure on DM is just the arc length measure supported on a periodic orbit. And as I mentioned before, examples of this type arise from the decagon and the featured Z table. Okay. So that's one type. We have just one more type that I'm going to describe. Okay. All right. These are measures of the type X star mu, where mu is one of McMullen's ergodic invariant SL2R invariant ergodic probability measures on DM. These are, in fact, also U-invariant ergodic probability measures. Okay, this X star mu is the pushward of mu by a horizontal vector X. Okay, so I define X down here. X is the set of horizontal vectors in R2. Okay, and how are we thinking of X star mu? Well, remember that for sufficiently small vectors, you can take a translation surface and perturb it by a vector. Okay, so we're going to be considering, you play an important role in the theorem, perturbations by horizontal vectors. Okay, that is vectors in this describe set X. Okay? So Y are McMullen's measures, and push forwards, X star mu of McMullen's measures, of the type that we want. Well, you can use representation theory to show that if mu is SL2R invariant ergodic, then it's also U invariant ergodic. Now, one can also show that for each measure mu of McMullen's type, the subset of GM, which consists of all those surfaces which can be perturbed by any horizontal vector, is connull. Okay? So that means that the push-forward measure, X star mu, is a well-defined probability measure on GM. And finally, U and X commute. Okay? That's another way of saying that if you take a translation surface, perturb it by a horizontal vector, and then shear by the element U, that's the same thing as shearing first in the horizontal direction and then perturbing by a horizontal vector. Okay? So since mu, the McMullen's type of measure, is U invariant, and since U and X commute, that means that the push-forward measure X star mu is also U invariant. What? Yeah. There's a conull. Yeah. Okay. So the theorem that I have with Wortmann says that basically those two types of U invariant ergodic probability measures that I just described are the only ones that exist and that are supported on DM. So that's, I guess I'm out of time. If you want to talk to me about ingredients in the proof of the theorem, I'd be happy to discuss after the talk, but I guess I should stop now.